Hello and welcome to Beauty at Work. We are in between seasons at the moment, so please enjoy this clip from one of our earlier episodes. How is beauty relevant when it comes to innovation? Cultural historian Dr. Luca Cottini uses examples from Italian culture's focus on creativity and relationality in this clip to explain how beauty promotes innovation in industry. Here's what he had to say.
Well, this is something that relates to Italian culture in general, and that might be an interesting contribution to a different understanding of ourselves here in the United States. The first thing I would say about Italian culture is that in the education system, the humanities have a more predominant position. So it's a humanities-centered kind of education, whereas here it's kind of like a STEM-centered form of schooling. In this sense, the humanities provide a holistic understanding of a culture, which might find a reflection in the peculiar Italian setting or in the peculiar Italian creation of movements that are in se interdisciplinary. If you think about the Renaissance, the Baroque, or in modern times, Futurism or Neorealism, they are all movements that start from a dominant aesthetic idea and apply it through different languages. So the Renaissance is not just painting, but it's the idea of the harmony of parts, the rediscovery of the classics, applied in painting, in sculpture, in architecture, in theater, in literature as well. In the same way as the aesthetic idea of modernity and the future, that the futurists bring forth, applies to the vision of design, photography, literature, theater. So this is an interesting model. Instead of like an over-specialization on one idea disconnected from all the other languages, instead the ability to turn one single idea, one innovative idea, into a platform to create different languages that are informed by that idea, but have their own autonomy. In this sense, a good equivalent for the industrial world can come from the industry Campari, drinks, the aperitif. And Campari is really an interesting avant-garde in marketing communication because they turn a drink, a red drink, into a platform that can generate different other languages. So they invested a lot in photography. They invested in cinema. So just to give you a sense, Fellini and Sorrentino, the last Italian director to win the Academy Award, did mini movies for Campari. Campari started to promote architecture, became really one of the platforms for the development of new architectural structures. So the idea of one overarching idea that kind of spreads and permeates other linguistic forms or aesthetic languages, reinventing them anew. And the last thing I would say about Italian culture is that it's a very relational culture. So the social dimension of relations translates into products that are tools for a dialogue and not just tools for trade in the sense of just monetary exchange. And the relational structure or the relational space par excellence is the piazza. So the place where people get together, where identities are negotiated, even in conflictual terms, if you want, but where people truly engage with each other and are truly communicating something to each other. This is something that can become translatable on the internet, but too often is not, because the internet tends to relegate the individual bodies in their individual kind of compartments. It's actually way more convenient. but this generates first miscomprehensions and then a flat dimension of the product as just something that produces a monetary functional value, when the actual value of the product is the story and the breadth that it contains and how it means something to us. And this is something that we can learn from the Italian environment, certainly.
Yeah. Well, can you tell me from your experience of, the various examples of innovators you've studied in the last little while, are there examples that stand out to you of how encounters with beauty have spurred creativity or innovation? Is there anything that comes to mind that can help illuminate what role beauty plays in that process of innovation?
Well, there are certainly in the industrial environment numerous examples of the relationship between the industry and the creation of beautiful environments. I would name three. One is the example of Ermenegildo Zegna. It's kind of the leading company in the wool production of wool. It's one of the top fashion brands. What is interesting is that the company, which was founded in northern Piedmont, northern Italy, in the 1910s, by Ermenegildo Zegna, launched in the 1930s an incredible project of reforestation around the factory, the main plant. So in the 1930s, the founder planted 500,000 trees around the plant to create what now is called an oasis, Oasi Zegna, which has become kind of a protected area. His whole idea was to connect the production of wool to the beauty of the natural environment. So to bypass the kind of inevitable alienation of work and connect the work of wool to its natural source and also to its natural environment. How many times we lose sense of the nature behind, for example, the food that we eat, where it comes from. And so in this sense, he wanted to connect what we wear, like the production of wool, to that sense of beauty that comes from being part of an environment, of a beautiful natural environment. The second example is Brunello Cucinelli, is the king of Kashmir. In Umbria, central Italy, he created a company which is all based on philosophy. So basically in his board, he has like Benedictine monks, philosophers, and he basically built a little city, or actually a Renaissance city called Solomeo, around the headquarters of the company. The city is based on the ideal Renaissance city. And it's basically an attempt to connect the workers of his company to a balanced and harmonic lifestyle. So he actually offers them a bonus for theater and culture. So they are required to attend like a theater play every month and to spend a certain number of hours in the library. And they are given like a two-hour lunch break, that's not bad, to connect their work to a life that is meaningful and not kind of deprive work of its breath. The third example is Olivetti. It's probably the most famous. Olivetti was the leading brand in typewriters. Actually, Olivetti was the company that produced the first computer ever, the Elea, in 1959. And it's based in Ivrea, still in, near Zegna in Piedmont. And Ivrea was conceived as a comunità, a community. So the idea of Adriano Olivetti, who is also the model of Steve Jobs, was to create a working site where architects, designers, workers, philosophers could interact together, similar to the space of Cupertino, if you want. This also became a political project that didn't go very much far because like Olivetti died very young, but this was the idea of connecting work to society as a harmonic balance of parts and contributions. So I think these are good examples of how beauty connects to innovation, technological innovation. In a way, if you want to go back to the Renaissance, also Leon Battista Alberti, who was the one who discovered perspective, was the one who really connected the understanding of geometry to the design of architectures. If you go to Florence, the facade of Santa Maria Novella, it's like a beautiful church near the train station, is actually based on geometric forms applied to space. So how to use math as a geometrical form that inspires beauty and uplifts kind of our souls in a way in observing it. So this can be good examples then for many more, but
yeah. No, there's a lot of interesting insights there. Would you say that there are any sort of unique or distinctive aesthetic principles that come out of the Italian context or that that characterize, say, if we look at scientific or technological innovation in Italy today, are there any particularly distinctive or common aesthetic principles that are sort of particular to that context?
I would not call them principles, but more frames or frameworks, in the sense that if we compare the Italian and American approach or frameworks to innovation, we might see certain differences. Well, we highlighted the difference between kind of a technological approach and a humanistic approach, which might also be read as a difference between kind of a short-term, immediate solution approach versus a long-run, longer continuity approach.
I think of Cucinelli's got like a 200 or 500 year vision or something like that.
Not a 3-year range, but a 300 year range. Right. And this translates, for example, in the approach to management. Managers in the Anglo-Saxon world tend to move from one company to another and execute what they are asked to do in the short run. Entrepreneurs in the Italian context are more like medieval captains in a way. So they are the ones that are interested in running the, what in Italian is called impresa, which means both company and adventurous feat. That's quite a remarkable overlapping of terms. And if someone is running this impresa, this feat, has the interest to prolong this impresa over generations. So this is where the family model comes from. We see it in a negative sense in the house of Gucci, but for example, in the case of Zegna, which arrived at the third generation, we see how instead this model generates continuity over time and also loyalty over time. We see this also in Il Caffè, the third generation, in Lavazza as well. Or for example, in the craziest example, in the company Marinelli, located in Molise, southern Italy, which is the longest running company in the world. It started in the Middle Ages and produces bells. So it's been going on for 8 centuries. So this is the idea of entrepreneurship as a long run adventure. So this might be one framework, technology versus humanities. The idea of like the short-term solution versus kind of the long-run horizon. The last one is kind of the opposition between the pioneering framework of the American West, if you say, so the new frontier framework, innovation as finding a new uncharted land or territory, which then translates into the conquest of the West, the conquest of space, the conquest of whatever else is more West than where we are. And the Italian model of innovation, which I equate to the model of the snail, which is to look backwards to move forward. So the idea of heritage or tradition as something that is given from the past and is not rejected to make room for something new, as in the dynamic of fashion or modernity. Mm. But it's actually rediscovered and used as a vital force to create new grounded solutions. Now, the pioneering model is actually a model that produces new ideas, but also produces a lot of like ideas that fade pretty quickly. If you think about science, what we call science is what is left of a number of scientific hypotheses that the vast majority that faded over time. So in this sense, also products, what we see, or classics, what we see is what is left of these pioneering attitudes that found something but also left a lot of other things along the way. The Italian model instead is a model where the presence, which is kind of a special presence of the past in the geography, in the urban geography of Italy, and the cultural imagination, can be seen as a burden or can be seen as a resource. In this sense, design is born out of the reappropriation of something that is in the past and something that grounds innovation, that produces something new, but not flat, new with depth. And this is quite an interesting paradox because, like, we tend to think of originality only in the sense of novelty. But how is it possible to create something truly original and truly substantive at the same time? That's kind of the challenge. And in this sense, the Italian and American models put together can generate very, very interesting solutions.
Yeah. Well, that's a fascinating point. I've certainly seen this in a lot of Italian firms. I've been working with a team of sociologists at the Università Cattolica in Milan, and they're looking at, you know, organizations that are exemplars of social generativity, and they do find that there's a certain model of innovation that is grounded in tradition and also identity, right? So this idea of in this region, this is what we have been producing for centuries, and so there's a certain kind of rootedness, a certain kind of tradition, which doesn't really have to enslave you. You can certainly deviate, but there's also that sense of fidelity to something that's been given, and I suppose it provides a more stable foundation from which to innovate, perhaps. Do you see, one of the things I want to ask you about is whether there's a dark side to beauty. So in, I'll give you an example in some of the work, some of the debates that are going on in say theoretical physics, actually around CERN and particle physics and so forth, there's an argument that on the one hand, beautiful mathematics can be a guide to truth. It's what leads people to develop ideas for what to investigate, what to invest their money in investigating, what kinds of hypotheses to pursue. And so you go for the ones that are most mathematically elegant and beautiful, trusting that beauty will lead you to truth. However, in the last 50 or 60 years, that approach somehow hasn't been working. And people have argued that we're wasting our time and we're wasting our money pursuing beauty where it's no longer going to be fruitful. So essentially the argument is it's become a source of cognitive bias. So I'm curious to know what you think about beauty or aesthetic principles as, in spite of whatever advantages they have, could they also be perhaps a blind spot? Could they also close us off to innovation or to directions that we might otherwise take?
Well, thank you. This is a truly interesting space. I would say a couple of things. One related to the opposition that took place between the 16th and 17th century between two aesthetic systems, one the Renaissance system and the other one the Baroque system. And the second observation relates to the importance of fiction for scientific research and for technological innovation. The first thing, the Renaissance, as you know, is kind of a harmonic system that works well, looks nice, but imposes a very rigid frame on other possibilities, simply. So in this sense, the beauty, the harmonious beauty promoted by the Renaissance, later by neoclassicism, is more of an ideological beauty. I tend to see kind of the Vitruvian man of Leonardo as an impossible man, the man inscribed in the circle and in the square, or rather as a forced man, someone who is forced to enter or to fit within those parameters that we impose. Well, the Vitruvian man does not exist. I have never seen someone who has the exact proportions of the Vitruvian man. Our body is different. So in this sense, what the Baroque promotes is more of an irrational side, the emphasis on the darker side, on something we cannot really control, or on impulses, on the forces and dynamism that might lead also to entropy. So there is a value in the beauty of entropy for scientific research. So the study of complexity, not as a study of systems that are already pre-formatted, but the study of complexity as something that appears perhaps randomly, perhaps through the emergence of an irrational force. Now, Nietzsche observed the contrast between the Renaissance and the Baroque through the contrast of the Apollinean and the Dionysian spirit. Actually, Nietzsche was the first one who rediscovered the Baroque as a valuable vital force and not as a grotesque, bizarre, negative art as it was portrayed in the 18th century. So in this sense, when we talk about beauty, we need to figure out what kind of beauty are we talking about, or models of beauty, the model of the harmonious classicism or the model of beauty as a punch in the face that sparks a reflection. And in this sense, we all have movies that we like, and this binary opposition translates into those who like movies that are well-framed, beginning, development, end, maybe with a cheesy end, or movies that really punch you in the guts and that open up a space of reflection. And that space of reflection might generate more knowledge than the cheesy sensation or feelings that we might have in a more fully formed movie. Now, this leads me to the second consideration on fiction, because fiction is really a space of test. It's a virtual space where we test ideas, where we see if moral categories or maybe certain ideas in science, think of like science fiction, can work or not. In a way, in entrepreneurial terms, this is kind of the forerunner of what we call now virtual reality. So fiction is based upon the premise, well, let's pretend this is this. It opens a bubble in our world, which is something that does not exist. Theoretically, fiction is a lie. But through this bubble that does not exist, we might understand if certain categories work beforehand, before making an investment, a heavy investment on them. This is kind of the virtual reality proposition, but also to understand and see things that might be more visible there than in the direct vision of reality. So in this sense, fiction as a cognitive space that allows us to postulate ideas, to imagine new horizons. We tend to think of imagination as something that is fake or false, but actually imagination is the space where we allow ourselves to exit our pre-formatted knowledge and kind of brainstorm other possible ideas. So in this sense, imagination and fiction as testing grounds, but also places where we reframe problems beyond the somewhat superficial logic of the immediate solution, because sometimes the immediate solution is not what we're looking for. It's actually the reframing of the problem that allows us to see actually the bigger solution, what we are really interested in.
Beauty at Work is brought to you by Templeton Religion Trust. If you enjoyed this clip, go check out the full episode. And please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a review. It really helps get the word out about the show. Thanks, and see you next time.